Welcome to the This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I, your weekly roundup of the top personal finance, consumer and business stories that editor Simon Lambert and his team have been covering on their award-winning website. I'm your host, Georgie Frost. Alongside Simon Nye is knowledge and product editor Laura Whitcomb. And coming up today, not much could have overshadowed the biggest ever peacetime repatriation after the collapse of Monarch Airlines this week, left over 100,000 people abroad. But Theresa May managed it, and not in a good way. Between the pranksters, falling letters, coughing fits, you may not have actually caught the content of the Prime Minister's speech, but in there was a price cap on rip-off energy bills, investment in Help to Buy, and a freeze on university tuition fees. So we'll run the rule over the proposals. Also, warnings that millions of workers with final salary schemes have just a 50-50 chance of getting a full payout, more anger over the new flat rate pension, and why everyone should know what open banking is. Plus, we tell you the biggest turnoffs for prospective home buyers, and just how much is a tenner worth? Well, a heck of a lot. All that and plenty more coming up. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security, backed by HM Treasury.
But first...
Get out! Get out! Out! Come! Get out! Out!
Remember last week when I said conference season was like the Glastonbury of the political season? Lots of people go, and it gets rather messy. Well, I had absolutely no idea how messy it would get for Theresa May and the Conservative Party. Less a music festival and more a comedy of errors.
So, we will never hesitate to act where businesses aren't operating as they should. Let this party celebrate the wealth creators, the risk takers, the innovators and entrepreneurs.
Firstly, I just want to say as a broadcaster, I have huge sympathy for Mrs. May when it comes to the coughing fit. That can happen to any of us, as everyone in the studio will attest to. Just remember, as a little bit of advice here, have some tepid water with you. Take big glugs of it. Never take a lozenge from the Chancellor or indeed anyone. And for goodness sake, rest your voice before you've got a big event if you have a cold. But this is not a vocal coaching class. So sidestepping the pranksters with the P45, the falling letters, the accusations of West Wing plagiarism, and yes, the coughing, we're going to take the rather unusual move, it would seem, of heading straight for some of the policy proposals, the ones that will affect the pound in your pocket. So we'll get onto price energy caps shortly, but just to run through on some of the other measures, please. Has everyone got some warm, tepid water in front of them, Simon? Yeah.
I do.
Ready
yes.
to go for it?
I have slightly cold water because I don't have that much of a cough. But as okay. you say, I've also sat here in this studio and done various radio and TV gigs over the years with a cough, and it is painful. It's very difficult to do. And if you've got to stand up and speak for an hour, was she speaking for an hour?
Yeah, 65 minutes it was.
Yeah, then that is very difficult. And I don't think that we should forget the letters falling off the wall behind her, which is one of the funniest things I've seen in a very long time. However, back to the question at hand, policies.
Yep.
Well, it's not like we've been short on a few policies this year, is it? I mean, policies. Last year, Brexit, we'd had enough of experts. Mm-hmm. This year, we've probably had enough of policies. Anyway, there's a few more. They're helped by, this was originally George Osborne's plan to desperately find some growth from somewhere when he was being lambasted. And having given up on all the other options, he rolled the dice on the housing market. House prices have jumped lots since then. This bit of help to buy basically gives people who are buying new build houses a up to 25% interest-free loan for 5 years. And it's basically a massive subsidy for people buying new build houses and for house builders, effectively. And realistically, if you think about it, it's also a pretty daft idea, because what you're doing is giving the people who are trying to buy something that is too expensive for them to afford some free money to buy it, which does nothing to solve the issue of the thing being too expensive in the first place. And in fact, what we would have been better doing I've said before, is a thing called Help to Build, where we lent the builders interest-free money, which would have then lowered the cost of building the houses and meant that they could sell them at a cheaper price, but probably wasn't going to be too palatable bunging interest-free cash to builders. We've got another £2 billion to go towards building council houses.
They're talking about 25,000 homes over the next, what is it, 5 years? That doesn't seem very many.
It doesn't until you look at the number of council houses that we currently build and realise that that's about 25,000 more than we're currently building. If you actually look at the house building statistics, privately built homes, i.e. those for private sale, and then you look at social homes, it's those social homes, whether they're council homes or housing association homes, that actually there's the huge gap in. You'd expect privately built homes to ebb and flow because that would rise and fall with essentially the economy and how well the house building industry is doing. And that, if ever there's been a boom and bust industry, it's the house building industry. And unsurprisingly, all of these major builders that nearly went bust, they nearly went out of business, out of existence 10 years ago, are being quite cautious at the moment. So you can't necessarily expect them to build the volume of houses that the government wants, because if they do that and then the property market crashes, they'll all go bust. And what's, is the government going to step in and save them then?
So that's the housing. What about young people? Lots of noises about what the Conservatives could do for young people, because they realised at the election that actually young people do get out and vote, not for Conservatives. So we had a freeze on university tuition fee increases. Tell us a bit more about that, and do you think this will work?
It all brought home to me how stupid it was in the first place to ever let the system get to a point where any university and any course was able to charge the maximum fee. And that makes absolutely no allowance for quality or how likely the student is to find a decent paid job upon graduation. So you've seen, you know, an explosion in the amount of money that universities can take in, but that hasn't done anything really to improve the students' chances of that well-paid job. So I do think upping the threshold at which the student will start repaying the loan is a good thing. You know, 25,000 is more realistic.
From 21,
from,
wasn't it?
From 21, yeah. I think that's a good thing. But it all seems a little too little, too late. You know, from the year that I graduated, which was 2006, after a three-year course, a year in industry, I came out with £11,000 of debt. Mm. My stepsister that graduated only a couple of years ago, after a three-year course, she's got £50,000 of debt. Now, my parents did have to fork up tuition fee money in advance of me starting. I couldn't have contributed to that. And I know that was quite a challenge for my parents at the time. And now you do have the system whereby it's free at the point of entry. And I do agree that that is a social advantage for students. But to be burdened with that massive sounding debt, even if we do just approach it as a graduate tax and, you know, say that is the price for this education, I think that's a really scary prospect for people.
Laura makes an interesting point there, Simon, which I will link to the energy price cap. It seems to have caught ministers by surprise, the fact that they've said that universities can charge £9,250 and lo and behold, they all raise their prices. So is there not a fear, therefore, that if you introduce an energy price cap, we could actually see lots of companies will just raise their prices?
Yes, I think that that is one of the major problems with any form of price cap. Prices tend to move up with the cap. So if you bring in an inflation-linked cap, prices will tend to move up with inflation, whereas actually in a normal market, prices might move up by less than inflation. Inflation, you know, it's an average number of everything, and some things go up by less. Also, you get bunching around the cap. And I think that with the student fees, there's a lot to be learned from that system. I think the student fees thing is an example of one of the most particularly stupid systems I have ever seen introduced. And we've seen some particularly stupid things introduced over recent years, so that's a fine honour. Because essentially you need to make the decision as to whether education is a social good or not. And if you're trying to put as many people into education as possible and educate your population, you've basically decided it's a social good. Therefore, if it's a social good, you should probably subsidise it and not be too concerned with the, is this one person individually benefiting from it versus this other person who isn't? So there's the argument of, why should the person who leaves school and becomes a builder pay money in tax that goes towards the person who goes to university and becomes a doctor? Well, one day that builder's going to need a doctor. And also you're just raising the overall prosperity of the country, the knowledge base and things like that. It's a social good. So you shouldn't necessarily be charging them as much as you possibly can. Secondly, you need to look at things in context. So the context that we have here is that we have a problem with debt. We have a big problem with personal debt. We have a problem with people living above their means. And we have a problem with people needing to take on huge mortgages to pay for houses that are very, very expensive. So do you want to introduce a system that burdens as many young people as you possibly can, because we're trying to get as many people as possible into university, with a huge amount of debt? Probably not. And then on top of that, do you want to justify that system to them by telling them, don't worry about the debt, you probably won't have to pay it all off, which is literally monthly credit card payment logic. And it sets people up very, very badly for their financial lives when they basically come out of school at the age of 18, get bundled off to university and soak up £50,000 worth of debt with the message, don't worry, you might never pay it off. And then they come out and they've got all kinds of issues with repayments and stuff like that. And I do think that actually people should be paying this off. I mean, I don't necessarily think that raising the repayment threshold is a particularly good idea. In fact, they should probably lower it. And I don't think we should have a graduate tax because we decided it's a social good. I think what we need to come up with is basically lower tuition fees, a lower interest rate. Charging people RPI plus something is insane when RPI isn't even official inflation figure anymore and is higher than CPI. And then to charge it plus is completely mad. Why aren't we just charging people CPI inflation as a maximum? And thirdly, we need to look at all of these things together in context and go, is this a bad idea? Which brings me back to the energy bills price cap.
Okay.
So the system we have at the moment is dominated by six big companies. They offer cheap deals to the internet savvy who switch around and get their cheap deals. And they help to pay for those cheap deals by the fact that they know that when people come off the end of those cheap deals, invariably they probably won't go get another one. There'll be a chunk of really smart people who are always getting the cheapest one. And then there'll be a chunk of slightly smart people who get themselves one or two cheap ones and then just can't be bothered and go on to this standard variable deal. And then there'll be a big chunk of people who just can't be bothered to switch. And then there'll be a smaller chunk of people who actually would find it quite difficult to do it because they're not internet savvy. So what you've got is the people in the know are being subsidised by the people who aren't in the know or find it difficult or can't be bothered. So we do have a problem with that system. Is a price cap on those standard variable tariffs going to help that though? Arguably no, it's not, because one of the problems is the standard variable tariff in itself. It's this amount that moves up and down. And so capping it does in one way solve the problem, because it says, look, we've spotted this sneaky thing that you're doing and we're going to crack down on it, but it doesn't remove it. And one of the ideas that was put forward was actually banning standard variable tariffs completely and just making the companies offer people a series of fixed tariffs that would at least get people into the mind of, this is running out, you need to do something about this. But then the problem is you then need a default option. And if the default option is that they just move on to another fixed rate that's just a standard fixed rate, it's going to look a little bit like a standard variable tariff to me. So I think it's quite a complex problem. And I think the solution that's being brought to deal with it is way too simple and is just going to cause a number of knock-on effects down the line, like this bunching of prices. Actually, I think that the big problem is the big six energy companies, and the opaqueness of the pricing and the fact that they always seem to put prices up by plenty when gas or electricity prices rise, but not bring them down by so much when gas and electricity prices fall, and that they all seem to move in lockstep, and it doesn't appear to be particularly great competition there. But the best way to save money is not to wait for this, it's to switch.
Why are we in a situation where the Prime Minister is talking about rip off energy bills, broken markets? How did we get here, and therefore how do we solve it?
Well, I think the problem is that not all consumers are responsible as they could be. Now, I know there's a lot of shades of grey on that statement. There are people that, for whatever reason, don't have access to the internet, that they're not internet savvy, that they find it very complicated to take any of their financial affairs into consideration. But I mean, I'm a massive proponent of getting more and better financial education to children and to people at all aspects of their life, to try to make sure that we reinforce positive behaviour, good habits, responsibility, whether it's taking a credit card deal and knowing that you should never just pay the minimum repayment, maybe questioning whether you need a credit card at all in the first place. Whatever the financial prospect is ahead of you, I think we've got to engage people so that they really understand that this has to be a priority in life. Because if you fall each individual financial hurdle, if you never try to find yourself a better deal, nobody's going to do it for you. And before you know it, society is just going to be burdened by every financial problem that they possibly can be. So I really think a big step forward would be to start teaching children financial education in primary school. It should be on the curriculum and it should be assessed, as it is on the curriculum for older children, but it's still not assessed. We don't do anything for students, really. You know, some universities might offer a course, and it's the same in the workplace. So I think it's up to publications like This Is Money and everyone else to really champion the importance of just spending some time going through your financial life.
Is it surely all on us? And I absolutely agree with you. I do think that people need to be better educated in money, and the best places to go are places like This Is Money. No question about it. However, is it all on people?
Well, it is a problem that has been delivered by the internet, essentially, by the ability to easily compare prices, the ability to find the best possible savings rate, the ability to find the cheapest possible energy deal, means that what companies do is they compete to offer the best price to those people in the know, and then they need to make some profit back somewhere else. So they charge people who aren't in the know some more profit. And that's just the capitalist free market system. And you can try and legislate it out of existence, but you're probably going to remove a huge amount of innovation from it, because the innovation behind comparing all that kind of stuff has delivered a great benefit to all of our lives. But what you need to do, if you've decided it's enough of a problem, maybe, for example, like with these standard variable tariffs on energy, is you make those standard variable tariffs unattractive to the companies to offer by maybe telling them that if you are going to bring in a cap, or what you say, it can't be higher than the average of the 10 cheapest fixed rate energy deals or something like that. So there's a formula that it moves around, and it makes it less attractive to them to offer that standard variable tariff, because they're not going to be able to make so much money on it. But I had an idea this week that I wrote about in my column, and it's something I've talked about on the podcast before, which is you could wait for a price cap to work, or you could just do something about it. Yeah. Everybody knows someone who hasn't switched their energy bills, either because they can't be bothered, or maybe they are, stereotype here, older and don't use the internet or less savvy. So what you should do in the next 2 weeks, identify that person in your mind, go around their house, tell them that you're going to do them a favour and you're going to save them about £300 or £400, and sit there and switch their energy bills with them. And I reckon that within 2 weeks, we could save people millions of pounds and considerably more money than they would save from an energy price cap at a considerably earlier date. So I'm going to do it this weekend, and I'm going to switch someone who really should have done it themselves but hasn't. I'm going to switch my mum.
I was about to say...
Not for another mum, just to
mum,
be clear.
Mum, are you listening? You know the battles I've been having with mine. She will justify any which way she can as to why she hasn't. I don't understand, etc., etc. Mum, it's you and I this weekend. Right, I do want to ask you before we wrap this up, though, because it would be remiss not to ask you about the speech in itself, Simon, and what you thought, and the Conservative Party conference, and also a lot of what was said about free markets, about that price cap, certainly... I know business groups didn't like that interference idea. Are Conservatives the party for business anymore? How has Theresa May come out of this and the Conservative Party? Give me your assessment.
I think that there's been a lot of political wrangling following the Tory party conference, and there's been talk of an alleged coup. I don't know. I think Theresa May's going to limp on, to be perfectly honest. Most of her rivals would probably be crazy to take over from her right now. They're probably quite Machiavellian and thinking, let's wait till the Brexit deal or lack of deal is done, and then we'll try and take over. Let's let Theresa deal with the hospital pass, and then we'll try and take over. And in the meantime, let's cross our fingers and hope that Jeremy Corbyn implodes.
All right, then, let's continue with torrid times, shall we? It's been a torrid year for holidaymakers, and it shows absolutely no signs of letting up. Millions have already suffered travel chaos, from British Airways' computer system crash to Ryanair cancelling 24,000 flights due to a mess-up. And this week, we got the news that the UK's fifth biggest airline, Monarch, had collapsed.
It's really probably easier to talk about how much we were projecting to lose next year, and the figure was well over £100 million. And we couldn't figure out a way of reducing those losses significantly, either by selling the short-haul airline or by improving it. And we tried everything and asked for expert advice from respected consulting firms, but we just couldn't find a way in the end, and we reached the end of the road late on Saturday night, made the decision and filed on Monday morning.
Well, Chief Executive Andrew Swaffield there telling the Today programme he's absolutely devastated. Scant consolation, though, I imagine, to the 860,000 passengers who had bookings. This is Money Reader Simon was one of them.
So basically, booked flights in July to go to Tenerife, six flights, return. And it was only over the last weekend that I began seeing online news media that there was potentially issues with Monarch. So I just kept my eye on it. Interestingly, on Sunday, I got an email from Monarch asking me, did I want to book my seats and everything and pay a little bit more, which I didn't do because I knew, well, potentially they may not be around much longer. On the Monday morning, I checked news sites, see that they'd collapsed, and thought, I'm going to have to book tickets straight away. Hotels are booked and everything. So booked tickets, which were more expensive, of course. So lucky I did, because I checked on EasyJet, I booked the tickets with this time. I checked on their website a few hours later, and the flights that I would have wanted would have been £600 each when I got them for £250 with EasyJet. So prices were going up quite quickly. I never ever got a text or email from Monarch saying what had happened to them.
So how can you stop airlines sabotaging your holidays? Laura, firstly, bring us up to speed with Monarch, if you would. What went wrong? Where are we at? What about all those people abroad and those people with their holidays booked?
Oh, it's so, so sad. Well, I think the truth of it is we don't really know what went wrong with the company. It all happened so fast. But what we do know is there are a lot of people really worried about the holidays right now, whether they're on one and are worried about getting home, or they've booked one and they're worried about getting the money back and what they're going to do now. Lots of people also worried about their Christmas travel plans if things can get bad enough. And we know that those prices aren't likely to come down anytime soon. So speed is of the essence. So there's a couple of things we can do here. If you had booked a flight and have been affected, if you booked a flight with accommodation, you're probably protected by something called ATOL, which means that you should have your flights sorted out for you. Jump on to the ATOL website and the Civil Aviation Authority's website for a little bit more information there. But in a nutshell, if you booked flight and accommodation together, you're probably sorted. If you only booked the flights, it's a lot more complicated. If you did, and if you booked a flight that cost you more than £100 and you paid on your credit card, you can breathe a sigh of relief. Your credit card company is jointly liable. That's a very simple process. You call your credit card provider, they'll refund you. What they won't refund you for is any other costs you face in replacing the flight if you still need it.
It is worth pointing out at this point, though, if you have bought a single and a return as separate tickets,
yes,
and say they're both £99.99, the total is obviously over £100. However, they are viewed to be separate transactions, even if you bought it in one transaction. So the advice there is, actually, you can still sometimes go to your credit card company anyway, and they may just honour that.
So they have some discretion there. So call your company, explain the circumstances, and hopefully they will be nice about it. But the important point being that it's really sensible to know that anything you buy in life in general, if it's over £100, always put it on your credit cards, up to £30,000 and you're protected. It's similar for debit cards. So if you had paid on a debit card, it's more of a voluntary scheme, but lots of providers, like all the main ones, MasterCard, Visa, are signed up. So chances are you should get something too. Now, travel insurance has been the interesting one here, because a lot of people would just assume that if an airline went bust, they'd be protected. It's not really the case. Some research found that of 962 annual policies that were available on the market, £392 don't provide any cover for airline failure, 94 offer it as an add-on, so you pay more obviously, and 476 provided it as standard. It's only half. So it's really important in when you are comparing policies online, not to just go for the cheapest option, because the chances are if you go to a race to the bottom, you are going to miss out on these kinds of protections.
But I was about to say, the chances of your airline going bust, that then we've had three this year. We've had Air Berlin, Alitalia, and now Monarch. So is it worth getting that little bit of extra on your travel insurance, perhaps?
And if Ryanair are pleading with its pilots to come back to work, if they can't get them singing from the same hymn sheet, who knows what could happen in the years to come?
But it does make people question, why isn't this covered in travel insurance? What is the point? Is there a point to having travel insurance?
Yes. Because you are far more likely to fall ill than your travel companies to go bust. And if you do fall ill abroad, you could be landed with an absolutely colossal bill. So I would say, yes, it is worth still having travel insurance.
Yeah, and I would second that. Don't risk going away without it. It does do a lot of good. But like you said, do double check. Just don't go for the cheapest thing on offer.
Exactly.
Check what you think you might need. Simon, is this it for budget airlines? Could another fail, or is what we saw at Monarch just very specific to an airline that perhaps just didn't know what it was offering and got squeezed out by the cheaper airlines and by a turn of events like Brexit and terrorism?
No, it's the mark of the rise of the success of the budget airlines. This is one of the signs, one of the indicators, that the budget airlines are now not the budget airlines, as we used to call them. They are now the mainstream. EasyJet and Ryanair are now the dominant force in European air travel. And Monarch wasn't able to keep pace with it. Its business grew out of the package holiday industry. So it used to do a lot of charter flights. Obviously, then the bottom started to fall out of the package holiday industry. We started to book more of our trips ourselves, book our flights and our hotels separately. So they tried to do more of the standard scheduled flights and do the package holidays and those, but they never really cracked that. And I must admit that I'm not surprised at the failure of Monarch. I think it's sad, but I'm not surprised because to me, Monarch didn't differentiate themselves enough to make me think I'll fly Monarch. When I went to look at flights to go to Mallorca last year, I wanted to fly from Luton to Palma. Monarch fly there and EasyJet fly there. When you looked at the Monarch site, the flights looked like reasonable value, but actually once you went through, they were no cheaper than the EasyJet flights, or round about the same price. But then there was all kinds of little extras that you had to have added on, which was really annoying. So once you had added all the little extras on, you know, this much for a bag that weighed this much, or this much for a bag that weighed that much, or that much for a seat and things like that, the price went up loads. It added loads of money to the price, and they were then more expensive than the EasyJet flights. Why would you fly with them? Well, you might fly with them because you might think they're going to give you a better service. But I'd flown with them the year before, and I didn't get any better service than I got with EasyJet. So what I'm looking for is not necessarily the cheapest price. I'm looking for a better service, or the fact that when I book my flights with Monarch, I don't have to worry about paying for all those extra things like taking a bag and having a seat. That all just gets lumped in. So Monarch differentiates itself against the other airlines by going, here's the difference. You fly with us, we'll give you all of this stuff. You don't have to worry about all of that hassle. And then you go, okay, well, maybe I'll fly with Monarch. And it didn't do that. And to be fair, they tried to turn things around. The owners, private equity owners, this company, Greybull, chucked a load of extra money in. But it just didn't work. And I think that that is the problem, is if you are only going to compete on price, then you need to be cheaper. Mm. Otherwise, you need to compete on quality or something else. And I think that this is where BA are causing themselves all kinds of a headache at the moment, because there is now no reason to fly with BA in Europe over EasyJet, because they've removed all of the little perks that you used to have. And now you look at it and you go, well, why would I fly with you over EasyJet? And the last couple of times I've flown with BA, the plane's been delayed as well. You can only differentiate yourself really on two things, service or price. And if you aren't differentiating yourself on service, you're going to need to be cheaper. And if you can't be cheaper, you're in trouble.
The knock-on effect of all this, and I agree with you, the knock-on effect of all this, though, surely, is that with less competition, the EasyJets, the Ryanairs, could possibly raise their prices. Also, in the very short term, I've just gone on Expedia while you were talking, but it has a little warning at the front. So if you are thinking of booking a holiday, or you've got a holiday coming up and you're not going by Monarch or anything like that, it says, we are currently experiencing high call volumes due to Monarch Airlines ceasing operations. If your travel is within the next 72 hours, please visit our customer support page. For customers booked on Monarch Airlines, please consult our online travel alerts for more information. So I imagine the knock-on immediate effect of this is going to hit everyone who's got some sort of holiday, whether it's with Monarch or not.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound like a recipe for getting cheap airfares, does it?
No.
I'll tell you who is offering cheap airfares at the moment, though, that's very interesting. Norwegian Air started flying to New York, first of all, from London, pretty cheaply. Now they're flying to LA as well. I've got a friend who is flying to LA with Norwegian for about £300 return. Yeah, so that's quite interesting. It'll be interesting to see whether they manage to pull off what they're trying to do or whether that falls flat.
We'll see.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security backed by HM Treasury.
Well, we've had disasters and collapses, and now we look at warnings. Firstly, around pensions. Around 3 million workers with final salary schemes have just a 50-50 chance of getting a full payout. That's according to the Pension and Lifetime Savings Association. So, Simon Fessy, who are they and what is the warning?
The warning is, from the Pension and Lifetime Savings Association, this is a sort of industry body for pensions, is that basically people need to be a bit worried about their final salary pensions. People are living longer, not necessarily a problem, but is a problem for any company that has promised to pay out a certain amount of money to them for every year for the rest of their life. Low interest rates, which means very low returns on the money that has been invested in order to pay for these pension promises, usually in the government bond market in gilts, and weaker investment returns, which is linked to not great stock market performance, but also this weird scenario where the more the deficits grow and the more growth the pension schemes need to get, the more cautious they become in their investing, because the more worried they get about not filling that gap, and there's some rules around this that make them do it. But of course, that then makes them less likely to close the deficit. So there's a bit of a problem going on here. And what it means is that if you've got a final salary pension and you worked for a company that said, we will give you a percentage of your final salary or averaged across your career for every year that you've worked for us and been a member of the pension scheme, and we'll pay that to you for the rest of your life, and we will pay your spouse some money if you die. The cost of honouring those pension promises has rocketed. And so you've seen companies such as BT start to cut back on this. And what they're saying is, if you're still accruing benefits, you're probably not going to be accruing them for very long. And if you have already accrued these benefits and you've not yet retired, then you need to watch out, because your company might, for example, decide that it can't afford to meet its pension promises. And then you have things like you get pushed into the pension protection fund, which is a substantial safety net, but doesn't necessarily deliver the entire pension that you were expecting. I would say one thing, though, it is very, very difficult for a company to rid itself of its final salary, its defined benefit pension promises. They effectively have to go bust. So you're probably safer than maybe this suggests.
All right, then. On to our next warning. Big banking changes are coming in, but are customers happy about them? Not so much. Next year, a European directive will force banks to offer open access to customer data if consent is given. Now, it's called open banking, but it seems around 70% of us don't want to share our personal financial data with third-party providers. So who is going to take on to try and explain what is open banking and how it's going to impact us all, Laura?
So you could think about it as the opening up of bank systems that have your details, and it's a way for different financial service providers to utilize this huge data source to come up with products and services that may actually better suit everybody's needs. But to do that, they do need to share your information. Now, in a world where we're facing cyber attack after cyber attack, it is a very scary prospect for many people. But the first step is to understand that there are some real advantages for all of us by allowing sharing to take place. So, for instance, let's think about mortgage rates. At the moment, similar to an energy deal, after maybe 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, you may come off a fixed rate, which was quite competitive when you took it out, and you'll be reverted onto, you know, a standard variable rate, which is less competitive. If you opt out of open banking and you say, please don't share my details with anybody, that actually would stop a mortgage provider contacting you to say, do you know we actually have better rates than you're currently on and we could save you money or make you money? Maybe you've got a better savings rate available. So it's not as simple as saying, oh, I'm a little bit worried that criminals might be able to get their hands on my personal information, therefore I'm not going to share anything. Because if you do that, if everybody were to do that, the opportunity for innovation and progress will also be stifled. So it's a very complicated issue at the moment.
I wonder if it's not just hackers as well, because that sounds very much like you could get some cold calls saying, do you know our mortgage rate is the best one for you, etc., etc. So that is also, I imagine, a bit of a concern for a lot of people, Simon.
Yes, there's an understandable level of concern here, and I think that what that's linked to is the sheer volume of emails and contacts and everything else that we get from companies nowadays. And when I think about open banking and I think about all of these people telling me about all these smart bank accounts that I can have, where my bank account will tell me when it's time to switch my energy bills and time to switch my mortgage and time to do all these things, I think, well, that would be good, because in essence, it means I don't have to worry about it. In a way, it would get us around that problem we were talking about at the top of the podcast about people not switching their energy bills.
Exactly.
Just get their bank accounts to do it for them. On the other hand, I think, do I really want all of these messages and constantly being nudged by my bank account to do these things? No, not really. I want my bank account to keep my money in so I can spend my money and save my money and do these other things. And there's a lot of people who don't like change, for a start, and feel they don't want to be bothered by these things. And what they worry about is being constantly bothered. And I think that this is where companies have to hold their hands up and admit that they have failed. Because if companies had been a little bit more careful in how they contacted people and how they dealt with customers and how they did all these things, then people wouldn't be quite so worried about all this. And I'll tell you a little story that illustrates this. I bought some shirts from Next, and I made the mistake of deciding that I didn't want to pay the £3.99 home delivery charge and that I would have them deliver them to the store for free.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the nearest store to me is a sort of a drive round the corner. Next, in its wisdom, decided to deliver the four shirts that I bought in four different deliveries over a period of about a month. So it would email me and it would say, your shirt's in stock, in the store, you can go pick it up, and you've got 2 weeks. Now, unfortunately, the last two shirts, I managed to miss these emails, and they just ended up getting sent back to Next. And I contacted them and said, I didn't want these to be sent back. You know, can I just get them? And they said, oh, no, sorry, they're back in the system now. You can't have them. They're sold out. I said, I only got this email yesterday. They can't possibly have got rid of the shirts already. No, sorry, gone. Can't do anything about it. But the point I made to the lady, she said, we did email you to tell you they were in. I said, yeah, well, I was on holiday. And I said, also, I'm going back through my emails here. And in the 28 days since I ordered these shirts, or the month since I ordered these shirts, you have sent me 28 emails.
Wow.
How are you meant to find the email that you need to read in the middle of
Say
28 of them?
What?
So, well, four of them were telling me about the shirts and the other 24 were just like promotional spam. So understandably, you take that example and then you multiply it up by every company that you've ever dealt with sending you all of those emails. And you think, well, it's hardly surprising people don't want open banking, is it? But I do actually think open banking will be a good thing. I should say, I do think that some of the ideas people are putting out there about how to make your bank account do smart stuff, tell you how much you're spending, whether you'd be better off with that energy supplier or that energy supplier, whether you should move your mortgage and do all those things, has the power to save people large amounts of money and large amounts of effort. So I do actually think it is a good thing.
HSBC are making waves in this, are they not?
Well, yeah, they've just what they've done is they've created a new system where your bank account can pull in all the details from all of your other bank accounts and you can see them all in one place. Not really worth a massive fanfare because right. basically these services have actually been on offer from other providers for a long time now. There's a company called OnTrees. There's one called Mint, Money Dashboard. There's more of this stuff that goes on in the States. Not really taken off over here. The problem is that when you use these services, you can see all your accounts in one place, but you can't move the money. Mm-hmm. So it's not like just by logging into one of these services, you can then go move the money from this bank and that bank and that bank. You've still got to go individually log into
this
bank.
Will open banking change that?
Maybe, but there's security issues. And also one of the interesting things about it is not all the banks are entirely clear on where you'd stand if you were defrauded and you had given your login details to one of these services. And that's a concern for people.
Right, let me go into more detail about this because we've been touting some of these, particularly the likes of things like Moneybox, as a saviour to millennials struggling to save. It's where, you know, you round up your spending and then they invest it for you. But you have to link your bank to it. And banks are now warning customers, you can read it on This Is Money, to be extra careful. Experts suggesting that you could be breaking security agreements, like you said, by giving out your details. And you may actually struggle to get a refund should you become a victim of fraudsters. Now, some of these mobile phone apps you've mentioned, OnTrees, Money Dashboard, Moneybox, Chip, Clio, Plum, there's loads of them. Give us a bit more information about these apps, why they're so popular, and actually, do you have any protection? Because a lot of people right now be thinking, should I be getting rid of that I've just downloaded? And I've just been told to download because it's going to save me loads of money?
Well, look, in theory, you should have exactly the same protection that you have in the first place, because basically the way that the banking fraud stuff works is if the fraud is not your fault, then the bank should refund you. So say, for example, someone hacks your account and it's not your fault, you haven't been negligent, then the bank should refund you. Now, the question, the grey area is, many of them class being negligent as providing any form of third party, giving anyone else your login details. Have you been negligent by filling in those login details in another app? Now, in the spirit of open banking and in the spirit of what's going on, no, you have not been negligent. In the small print of your bank's contract with you, your bank could potentially argue that you've been negligent. And what I would like to see is the banks come out and stand by a position on this across the entire banking industry that says, this is the deal. Yes, we think this is safe. Or no, we don't think this is safe and this is the reason why. But these are the standards that we expect people to meet to make it safe. Because otherwise, what this looks like is the big banks suddenly start launching their own services and then start warning against using these smaller competitors. And I mean, that looks like big banks trying to put smaller competitors out of business who are actually doing lots of smart stuff and might be just as secure as using your big bank's version of this. But I do think that this is an area of confusion and people need to know where they stand, because what's going to happen is we're going to get a load of emails in about a year or two's time from readers who've been turned down by their bank when they've been defrauded through no fault of their own. And their bank's gone, oh, yes, but it says here in clause 5.4b that you shouldn't put your details in here and you did it. So, you know.
Do that again, Simon?
Can't.
Finally, if you are looking, we can leave that to one side. If you're looking to sell your home soon, listen up. Anything from noisy neighbours to smelly pets can deter potential buyers and force sellers to consider lowering their asking price to get their property sold. So knowing the biggest property turnoffs for house seekers can be a help in ensuring your home is snapped up in a timely manner. So what are they, Laura?
Swimming pools.
Is a bad thing.
Swimming pools are actually a bad thing.
I mean, wanted one when I was little.
Yeah, but when you were little, were you considering how much it might cost to run the thing to keep it warm and clean and sparkling bloom? This is the problem.
Loads of people want a swimming pool in theory, but then when it comes to in practice and they look at a house that's got a swimming pool, they just see problems and expenses. And then they think, I'm not going to buy. People don't buy houses because they've got swimming pools. There's more people who don't buy houses because they've got swimming pools than there are who buy houses because they've got swimming pools.
Exactly. So, other things people don't like. Dark rooms. Kirsty and Phil will tell you that week in, week out on their very popular property programme. Obviously, there are other property programmes available.
Photographic dark rooms.
No. So, don't paint your walls dark grey.
Oh, right. Sorry. Okay,
Or maybe magenta. Or any, you know, it's sensible stuff. People like to have light, bright rooms. They like to buy light, bright properties. People don't like buying houses that smell of dogs. People don't like buying houses if they're worried about Japanese knotweed, which is something horrible that can cost you an absolute fortune. Mortgage companies are so worried about it in areas that there have been known cases that they will insist on a surveyor going out to check whether it could still be a problem, because it can cause subsidence, which is obviously very worrying for any homeowner. People also are a little bit scared of solar panels. Solar panels are technology that changes very quickly, and if you buy a house that's already got it installed, it might be in a couple of years' time the technology's obsolete and you've got a big bill to put it all right or take it off. So there's actually quite a lot for anybody thinking about selling to think about, because the market isn't fantastic at the moment
and every little helps.
Yeah,
don't do weird stuff. Right. I mean, that's one answer to this. People like houses that look quite normal. Anything weird that you've done to your property, undo it before you try and sell it. And also, look at the estate agent's photographs, and if they aren't any good, make the estate agent come back round and take better photographs. You wouldn't believe the amount of estate agent's photographs you'll see where they're either out of shot or blurry, or something really simple like the curtains are closed or something like that. When you see good estate agent's photographs, they've decluttered the house and they've staged them to make the house look as good as possible. So, you know, do pay attention to that, because someone's only going to come around your house if they've probably seen it on the internet, as they got it flicked through it on Rightmove or something. So when it goes on Rightmove, make sure it looks nice.
Well, I did say that would be the last item, but actually we've had some breaking literal money news from Lee Boyce. And Simon, tell us what's been going on.
Well, one of the most important things in finance is, do you have money that is worth more than the money is meant to be worth? I think we've discovered that over the last couple of years. We've got new £5 notes. We've got odd coins. And we have a new £10 note. And the big question surrounding the new £10 note was, how much money is a low serial number one going to be worth? And we have found an answer today. The new tenner that has just sold for £7,200. This is the Jane Austen £10 note that smashed its estimate at the Bank of England auction. It was expected to fetch £2,000 to £3,000. Fierce bidding this morning erupted at the event in London held by auction house Spink. And the lowest serial numbered £10 note available to buy, which is AA01000010. This is very popular because it's got the one zeros in it, sold for £7,200. So there you go.
Editor Simon Lambert and Knowledge and Product Editor Laura Whitcomb, we're off to go check our wallets. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes and tell your friends and family and join in the conversation.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security, backed by HM Treasury.